Welcome. You're listening to Winning at Life. I'm your host, Gregory Ricks, the 401k and Retirement Authority.
I'm your co-host, James Parker, coming up on the show today. Man, we had such a weird day on Thursday. All three indices had a record close. First time that happened this millennium. I just like to make it sound the most extreme possible. Also, happy birthday, sort of, to Social Security. It turns 81 tomorrow. We're going to compare Trump versus Hillary. They both have their tax plans out there. So finally, we can kind of compare and contrast. And neither one of them seem to be that bad, actually. Can you believe that? Coming up in the 11 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to Wes Blanchard, the estate planning attorney of the Total Wealth Authority. And he's going to do some comparisons between wills and trust. And I always learn something when he's in studio with us. If you want to be a part of the show, you have a financial situation, you're not quite sure what to do, you better call Gregory, 504-260-0995. You can also reach out to us via the Gregory Ricks & Associates app, or you can do it the old-fashioned way. Email. Remember people used to email all the time? Gregory@GregoryRicks.com. What I want to start with today, though, is I'm kind of caught up in this Olympic fervor. And, you know,
really?
Well, yeah, look, the news is dominated by two things the last couple of days. All the rain, number one, and the Olympics. And that's pretty cool because I feel like we're actually getting a break from politics. They have an excuse finally to not just hammer that all day every day. So I'm sort of enjoying this week. Yes. From the financial situation, it's the same thing we say every Olympics. These poor cities that get the Olympics, they spend billions of dollars. They never make their money back. They always just lose tons. The taxpayers get fleeced in whatever world they go to. But man, have we ever had the Olympics in a third world country before? You know, the water's turning green. They're rowing through sewage. You know, there's all kinds of crime going on. This is one of the weirdest Olympics I've ever seen. But aside from the financial angle, let me tell you what really gets my goat about the Olympics. And I don't know why it didn't bother me so much in years past, but the swimming. The swimming's ridiculous. You know how many medals they give out for swimming, Gregory? Now, check this out. They have 17 events, but that means they have 17 events for each gender. So that's actually 34 events. And then each event gets three medals.
Over 90. Easy.
102. 102 medals for swimming, and they've been doing it for a week. They're going to do, I think they have some more swimming to do today, right? Well, you've been swimming for a week. We still don't know who the fastest swimmer is. You haven't figured it out by now. But what, Angie, what?
Of those medals, how many did Michael Phelps win? I'm sorry, just had to throw that out there.
Half of them.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you won half of them. Here's my problem, though, is swimming is okay when you're doing the freestyle. But the breaststroke, the butterfly, the backstroke, no, we don't do that. Like, they're about to start track. Doesn't the track start today? I think it starts this weekend. Well, they're going to have the 100-meter dash, and we're going to see who can run it the fastest. But they're not going to turn around in the next day and see, hey, let's see who can run the 100-meter dash the fastest backwards, which is what they do for swimming. Let's see who can swim the fastest backwards. That's not a sport. And let's do the butterfly. That is a very inefficient way to swim. Why would we even bother with the race like that? Again, my track comparison would be, okay, let's see who can do the 100-meter dash the fastest doing the bunny hop or hopping on one leg or skipping. Does that not bother you? You don't seem to be that concerned about it? Because it just seems bogus. Oh, who can swim the fastest backwards? Y'all are just making stuff up. Those medals don't count.
Well, you could say that for gymnastics.
Oh, I do say that for gymnastics.
Yeah, there's several different types of it.
Well, I have a different complaint about gymnastics. It's I don't consider anything that is solely, that's the key word, solely determined by judges. It's not a sport.
Well, have they had I've not kept up with it other than seeing the news flash of how many medals he's won. Have they done the swimming event? And I don't know what distance it should be. Well, if we kind of judge the fastest human on land running, that's typically 100 meters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Same thing in the water. Have they done that race? You just jump in the water and who makes it to 100 meters wins?
Yeah, that's the freestyle. And Michael Phelps won both, I think, the 100 and the 200. He's the fastest swimmer.
It's done. Over.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Gregory's on my side on this one. I thought he would push back and be like, oh, James, you sound silly today. And something else that kind of ruined swimming for me is, you watch them jump in the pool and these guys are hoofing it, right? And I'm sure they can swim 10 times faster than me. I'm not doubting them. But the announcers get you so amped up. They're like, this is the fastest human in water. These guys are going at blazing speed. But then they have that one little camera that's set up on a dolly on the one side of the pool. And it does sort of the level shot, not the overhead shot, not the high angle shot, not the front and back shot, that side shot that tracks with the swimmers. Here's what ruined it for me. I noticed earlier this week that there's some sort of Olympic officials or swim meet officials that are walking on the other side of the pool. And so there's these two chubby guys in blue blazers that are casually walking, and they're keeping pace with these people. And so they're not really swimming that fast after all. Okay, so yeah, Michael Phelps is fast in the water, fastest human being in the water. I can walk that fast.
But it's water. You can't walk that fast in the water.
Well, no, absolutely not.
That's not even, now you're going overboard. No. I was with you until you get to, well, I can walk faster than I can swim. Well, I can too.
I know, but doesn't it make it seem like unbelievably slow? Like, I thought these guys were basically just skipping on top of the water like you chunked a rock in the lake. But it turns out that they're going at what's just a moderate walking pace. That's about it. That's my
Well, it goes back to a shark gets in the pool with you. Who do you have to be faster?
I have to be faster than Angie. I don't have to be faster than the shark.
The next slowest person, you have to be faster than.
Yeah.
Same thing with a bear.
Yeah, when you're out camping.
Bear's coming. You said, I'm changing shoes right now, putting on my track shoes. Why? All I've got to do is beat you.
Yeah, honey, you can't outrun a bear. I don't have to outrun a bear. I just have to outrun you. Okay, something else we need to focus on before we get down to business is our next Gregory Ricks live event is coming up this Tuesday, Ruth's Chris in Metairie, 6:30 p.m. And what's really cool is this month's charity is Team Gleason. The Team Gleason I'm so cool. I think it's so cool we're going to be a part of that. So aside from the great financial advice and sort of the monetary first state between us and a bunch of people in the community here, we're going to raise some money for a good cause. And I don't think we talk about that much on the show. Talk about the charitable aspect of the Gregory Ricks Live events.
We've been doing that for a few years now. We charge $10 to attend, and then I'm going to match it. And we always donate to a local charity or a local chapter of a charity, anyhow. But our focus really is to be local on that. And typically it's about $1,000 every time that's raised from this event, and sometimes it's more, but it's been a focus for us to do that for a couple of years there, and I it's good to give back and make a difference locally.
You know, we have the buddies over at the Chalmette Movie Theater. I heard from them this week. They have the documentary Gleason playing over there, and Ellis was the one that reached out to me. He said, you have to come see this, and I'm going to warn you ahead of time, everybody in the movie that he looked at was crying. By the end of the movie, they were crying. He said he almost cried through the whole damn thing. And not like, you're just bawling like, boo-hoo, but you just looking and there's just water coming out of your eyes, you know, and you can blame it on dust or allergies like I always do because I don't have feelings. But I don't know if I want to watch this. I mean, how heart-wrenching is this going to be? So it's just I'm glad we can be a part of that with the Gregory Ricks Live event. Now, aside from that, why should you go to a Gregory Ricks Live event? I would start off by saying you need to be wary of the financial advisor who's willing to take you on as a client without getting to know you, without a process similar to this. So what do you think about that? Because would you say most fiduciaries don't have sort of a first aid experience like this? They'll just take you on as a client, sight unseen?
Oh, there's other firms that do something similar. I can't tell you who they are. It's not something I keep up with. And it's just a small part of what we do. We have most people just come and call and want to come in. But those that want to kick the tires, it's like going to the car lot after dark or after hours and checking out the cars. You get to do that in a non-threatening environment, you know, meaning nobody's going to make you do anything, ask you to do anything, or pressure you.
All right, so we're going to talk about what's coming up as far as the educational aspect, why you have to bring your spouse if possible, and stick around, because if you're not around to hear us talk to Wes Blanchard about wills versus trust, or talk about Social Security's birthday, or comparing Trump and Hillary's tax plan, come back to the podcast and hear it later. But we shall return on the other side of this break. 504-260-0995. I'm James Parker. This is Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO.
Welcome back. This is Winning at Life. You're listening to us on News Talk Radio 99.5 WRNO. And if you're not on the terrestrial, your car or home radio, as an example, then you're listening on the stream, which is through the iHeartRadio app. I was bringing James up to speed on the break regarding news event of the week, besides rain and Olympics. And I think it was, this story was ran in Times-Picayune and The Advocate, I think, yesterday. Going back, I did a little catching up on the news this morning, but that was the talk that got my attention. And 62 Metairie businesses won't be selling liquor next week. There's a couple of them got an exception to delay it later. And how does this happen? Well, they let a teenager buy without being carded. And yeah, it's a setup, but they let them do it. And it and it's a mix of bars, pharmacies, quick stops, restaurants. I just kind of ran through a list here. You know, you got Chevron's Gumbo Shop, Rite Aid on Betts, Causeway Shell,
man,
the Harbor on 17th Street, Bear's Po' Boys, Applebee's, CVS Pharmacy on Betts, Zia's.
I think the shorter list would be the bars that are still allowed to sell alcohol in Metairie tomorrow.
I think it would be a shorter list, but you just go through pretty much Carrabba's, New Orleans Food and Spirit, Zoe's Kitchen, Zita's, Little Tokyo. It just, it's a, that's a, if you're looking for beer, wine more likely, or just cocktail going out to eat, well, this is that week to do without it at some of your favorite restaurants.
Boy, if New Orleans did that, we would just shut down the city. Just turn off the lights, everyone go home. It's done for a week. So basically every store they
really,
tried sold?
Isn't this a state law that's being enforced, not a Metairie or Jefferson Parish?
Why would they do this? Look, I'm not against them enforcing
but
the
here
law.
Is but what it says, though. 62 Metairie businesses were caught selling alcohol to minors and thus won't be allowed to serve liquor to anyone for 1 to 2 weeks. The Jefferson Parish Council voted Wednesday, August 10th, to uphold the license suspensions by the Alcohol Beverage Permit Review Committee. So, well, yeah, so the parish was involved in that.
Okay, and something else I'm seeing here in the article, I saw this, I just didn't read it earlier. All 62 of these businesses are in one district. It's in Jennifer Van Vranken's district. Why are they picking on her district? Is this her baby? Is this her idea?
How long has she been in office? I think some of this happened before she was voted in.
I think she's only been in office a year. What, hasn't it just been a year or two?
Well, if this is happening there, I expect it to rotate through other districts.
Good thinking.
And parishes.
Good thinking. Here it goes. All in one district. That must be every restaurant in the district, or almost. Did anyone not in Jennifer Van Vranken's district sell to a teenager? And I'm kind of split on this because I think once you're 18, you should be able to buy alcohol. I think that 21 limit's ridiculous. But I mean, how young is a teenager? Is a teenager 19 and looks 30? Because some of those teenagers are very misleading, especially those big dudes that are like 6'4 and 300 pounds. What, Angie?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Parker, but isn't Louisiana still one of those states where if you're with your family at a restaurant and they purchase alcohol, you can still drink it legally?
Ooh, I don't.
I remember when I worked in a restaurant, we were told that was the case, as long as that's the parents were there.
That was the case when I was growing up in Texas, too, but maybe I think that might have been changed. I'm not sure. I can't answer for sure.
I wouldn't think that would be allowed knowingly.
I just remember when I was a kid, you know, my parents would order margarita. You want some? Fine. Here, just they'd slide over to me, taste it, and you're like, yeah, it's a little too sweet and alcoholy. But never mind. I don't want any. And give it back to them.
Yeah, I can say, yeah, that's probably been done before. But can't do it now because they won't let you have the drink back.
Oh, the kids? Yeah. My kids are not that cool yet.
Yeah, there's a couple other, just name sticks out. Arno's Restaurant was on there as well. There's a place called Cheers on Edenborn. I didn't know we have a Cheers.
It's probably, I'm 90% sure it's not the Cheers, though.
They're alcohol free for a week. Cafe Roma's another familiar name. Oh, Residence Inn on Galleria.
Do I know where that one's at? What's Residence Inn? The hotel.
Yes. Yeah, so
the hotel. Drinks.
Well, so this stinks because some of these places are actually just bars.
Yeah, some of them's bars. So, like, what do? You just close?
Yeah, well, you sing karaoke,
on vacation,
drink club soda. You can have a Diet Coke.
Yeah. What is this? Waloo's Sports Bar and Grill.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry. Waloo's.
Well, see, back in the day, Metairie, y'all remember Fat City?
Yeah. Oh, it's still there. Still,
well, not the way it used to be, though. It used to be just a group,
that was where
bars.
You went if you wanted to underage drink. Yeah,
exactly. I got it. That's where you started. But this is it's been a tradition in Jefferson Parish for years.
Oh, a tradition.
Stacy was asking about some place in Orleans that's kind of known for teenagers going to, and they serve alcohol.
What, the Boot?
That may be it. I don't know.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm just, well, this district got picked on. We'll see if others are enforced.
Someone got fired for this, too, didn't they? Hurricanes. What else is hurricane? Well, I guess hurricane does have food, too, but whew, that's a tough one.
Look, it's expensive. I don't know what management does on that on a case-by-case basis. But, gosh, after getting hit like this, there's got to be, like, zero tolerance. Card them.
Yeah, just card everybody.
Yeah, if you don't have gray hair, you're getting carded. So,
well, another thing that's hitting businesses, and I put this in your stat, Gregory, because you got to see this. This rundown on parking tickets. This one, I gave you the short list right here. Yeah. Check this out. Okay, so Greg LaRose from the Times-Picayune has done just some fantastic work this week, taking a look at parking tickets in New Orleans. Now, the brilliant thing he did is putting it in the context of other cities that are about the size of New Orleans. Because when you hear, when the report came out this week that more than 354,000 parking tickets were issued in New Orleans last year, you're like, that sounds like a lot. That's about equal to our population. But wait till you see how this compares to other municipalities of similar size. So about the closest one, because New Orleans is 388,000, Tulsa. 382,000 population, but Gregory, they didn't give out 345,000 tickets, nor did they collect $9.3 million off of those tickets. What was the numbers for Tulsa, Gregory?
19,000.
And how much money did they collect instead of 9.3 million? How much did they collect out of those tickets?
Barely made a dent in that 381,000.
Wow, that's so weird.
But is that really a fair comparison? Is it such a compressed city?
It's not. Colorado Springs, though, almost exactly the same size. They didn't give out 354,000 tickets either. Yeah. How many did they give out, Gregory?
32,000.
That's so weird. 32,000? That's like one-tenth. How much did they collect instead of 9.3 million?
A little better than half a million.
That is pathetic. Now, what, Angie?
Are these other cities also using third-party companies to give these tickets?
Now, he didn't go that far.
And is the third-party company getting a piece of the pie?
A third-party company's definitely getting a piece of the pie.
There you go.
Getting a huge amount of the piece of the pie. Now, there's another one, Minneapolis, which is almost exactly the same size as New Orleans, but it's even more compact because it has a sister city right next to it, St. Paul, that's almost the same size. Now, they have 7,000 meters in Minneapolis. New Orleans has just barely over 1,000, so about six times as many meters are in Minneapolis, but they only issued 200,000 tickets, not 354,000 tickets. So that we're definitely enforcing it on a much more harsh basis. Here's the thing that ticks me off, and I'm so glad Greg LaRose included this. He talked to some city officials about what seems to be, when you compare to other cities of similar size, far over enforcement. I mean, the focus on this is ridiculous. So the city officials told them, look, this isn't to raise money. This isn't a revenue generator. This is to improve the quality of life for residents and business owners. See, during carnival season, they add an emphasis on some of the parade routes so we can be sure that emergency vehicles can make turns on narrow streets and residents can leave their driveways. Oh, thank you. And also, parking meters along business corridors, especially like Magazine Street, make sure customers or employees don't sit there all day and take up parking spots. It keeps it churning so new customers can keep coming in. Oh, see, they're doing you a favor by enforcing the snot out of these ticket regulations. But you know why that's bogus, Gregory, right? Because if the concern was public safety, especially for emergency vehicles to be making turns and people to get out of their driveways, they wouldn't ticket them. They would tow them. Oh, really? This is unsafe? Well, we're just going to put a piece of paper on here and leave the car here. So the emergency vehicle still can't go by. Just bogus on its face. It's a revenue generator. Just admit it. It's a revenue generator. Right, Gregory?
Then they can boot you as well. But they've got those systems where they can just go by, drive down the road scanning plates.
That's what they do. 504-260-0995. I'm James Parker. It's Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO.
Contents of this show are meant for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to take place of your attorney, accountant, tax professional, personal trainer, football coach, interior decorator, or those fortune tellers at Jackson Square. Please consult a financial advisor before making all investment decisions. Now, back to Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks.
Gregory Ricks & Associates is a registered investment advisory firm. If you would like a copy of Form ADV, our required filings, you can call us 504-832-9200 or go to gregoryricks.com.
So it's a happy birthday tomorrow. Social Security turns 81 years old. Don't play the happy birthday song because we're not really celebrating this. It is, it's got some new... what's it called? Actuarial tables. We should start treating this like a living, breathing entity where we're only going to have payouts on Social Security for when does the 100% die? Oh, in 13 years, full benefits with the projections for the full benefits to be paid at 100% only stretch out for 13 years. Now, I agree with you. Someone's going to reform something before that 13 years is up. It doesn't mean you're not going to get your full Social Security check or 100% of whatever the retirement benefits are supposed to be in 13 years. That just means we're going to have to do something before this 13 years is up, and the sooner the better, as far as math is concerned. But the government's single largest spending program, 81 years old, and I took out the chunk of the CBO report that deals with it, and they put that on chapter two. That's how much of a grand budget issue this is. It was created in 1935. It is the single largest program in the federal budget. The two components of Social Security, the old age and survivors insurance and disability insurance, are now paying benefits right now to more than 60 million beneficiaries in all. So what is that, 20% of the population? We're about 320 million people kicking around here. So one out of five people are getting checks from Social Security. That's a lot. The program's mandatory outlays for fiscal year 2016, I did not think it was this high. This is ridiculous. $911 billion, Gregory. It wasn't but 25 years ago. That was the entire budget on the federal level of the United States. We're almost to $1 trillion. That's going to be the wake-up call. I think when we see that extra digit added to the spending, politicians will have a playground on which they can act without negative consequences. What do you think?
Well, that's the biggest part of our unfunded liabilities is the future increases there, as well as, you know, when they expect the disability income fund to be exhausted is in 2022 and Social Security income at 2030.
Okay.
We know a tax is coming. It's inevitable.
Yeah, and then to break it down, 71% of Social Security benefits are paid to retired workers and their dependents. Survivors receive 13%, disabled workers and their spouses and children receive 16% of that $911 billion in total spending. But if you go to page 23, Gregory, at the top left here, I want you to go through that second paragraph because this is sort of minutia, and this is something you deal with every day, and you've sort of explained it to me. But it's too complicated. I would prefer for you to go through that second paragraph and explain how these convoluted rules work on when your new FRA, full retirement age, is calculated. The worker's
this
birth year.
This one you're referring to?
This paragraph, yeah.
Okay. Worker's birth year determines the age of eligibility to receive full OASI payments.
Old age and survivor's insurance, yeah.
For example, any eligible worker born before 1938 could have claimed full retirement benefits at age 65. Under current law, upon reaching early eligibility of 62, any eligible worker may claim reduced benefits, and that's where you take that about 29.5% haircut, and we've talked about the stats many times. Most are taking benefits then. According to a schedule enacted in Social Security amendments in 1983, the FRA is rising incrementally. For workers born between 38 and 1942, it's increased by 2 months for each successive birth year, reaching 66 for workers who were born between 1943 and 1954. FRA will continue to rise gradually, starting at 66 and 2 months for workers born in 1955, who will turn 62 in 2017, and eventually reaching 67 for people born after 59, the youngest of whom will be 62 in 2022. So far, that's us.
Okay, so where does that put me? 67 then, huh?
67. Me as well.
Okay. And then it stops.
Right.
It's not going to keep going up after that? We've got to keep raising that, I think.
I think that'll be another adjustment. You know, they made that adjustment last year at the Year-End Budget Act and took away the deeming and the file and suspend, the spousal benefits can only be turned on when the primary's turned on. Now, you had a window that certain people fell into, but now it's going forward. There is no file and suspend.
I wish they would teach this in college or maybe even in high school, some classes. Like, they don't teach this anywhere. And you just have to go through life and figure out on your own when you can and can't turn on Social Security and what the implications are.
Well, it's not something you just... Well, we know it's not that simple. It's very complicated. And it's not just, oh, I'm 62, let's go turn it on. You have people still... I was in a meeting the other day, and they were not understanding the spousal benefit, trying to figure out, well, when can we turn on the spousal? Or if she takes hers, when can she turn it on? And there's an age gap between them as well. So for that, and he's not intending to turn it on till 70. So she's got a number of years to wait before she could switch to the spousal or get the spousal benefit on that. And it carries the haircut of her turning her benefit on at 62 when eligible. She's not there yet, but they were looking at what are the different scenarios to do so. Now, going forward, when they revisit this, yeah, it's going to get tweaked above 67 for the generations to follow. I think the taxes increase on it as well. The disability trust fund is much larger animal that's out of control. It's pretty much seems like everybody can qualify for it, and those that do, and we've talked about this many times, is there's no check up on that system.
We need to keep talking about that too.
Because that once they turn it on, you're getting it from now on. And there should be some sort of review on that.
The spousal situation gets even more complicated because they changed all the rules, and the rules just went into effect. God, it seems like a long time ago. I guess it was only 3 months ago a lot of those rules changed for the spousal, for the file and suspend. Some of the strategies went away. So even if you knew what you were talking about 2 years ago, you don't now unless you've been keeping up.
Yeah, you had to be 62 by December 31st, and if your spouse was going to be 66 by April 30th, I believe the date was, you needed to file and suspend so that that opportunity's there for the spousal to turn on income, where you didn't have to turn on benefits, but you could file and suspend, and then they could still turn on the spousal Social Security if they had made 62 by the previous December 31st and would also be in 62 in time would allow them to deem, meaning turn on their benefit and then defer the spousal as an example, or turn on the, I'm backwards on that, turn on the spousal and defer their benefit for it to keep increasing until age 70 is the max of the increasing 8% a year. So all that kind of changed right there. And if you weren't 62 or 66 by those dates, you're out. You're into the new system.
Okay, so what's left? The spousal can only be turned on once the primary guy or girl has theirs activated, then the spouse can turn it on?
Correct.
But that
weren't those ages. So if you weren't 62 or 66 by then you're falling into the primary income has to be turned on for a spousal benefit to be drawn from that.
Now, the spouse can still turn hers on early and switch to the spousal later.
Yeah, when she makes 66 and that he's turned his on.
But like you just said, she still carries that 29% or whenever she turned it on.
And you can't pick and choose which because you're going to turn on whichever is larger. You don't get that ability to deem or increase the benefit by selecting one. They're going to turn on whichever one's the largest benefit, and you're done.
Yeah, well, the funding mechanisms are going to be tweaked. I think the retirement age benefits or mechanisms are going to be tweaked as well. But as far as the funding goes, it comes from tax revenue from two sources. And I forget about this. You've mentioned it to me before, but I'm just more like the common man on the street than the fiduciary over here. 96% of the funding for Social Security comes from the payroll tax. It's 12.4% of earnings. We supposedly pay half and the employer pays the other half, but who are we kidding? We pay the whole thing. The other 4%, where does that come from, Gregory? It comes from benefits that are paid out to retirees, survivors, and the disabled, and they get taxed on their Social Security check. That's where the remaining 4% of revenue comes from, income taxes on Social Security benefits to recipients.
Depends on the income level. Social Security benefits can be taxed untaxed at a certain level, then 50%, and then max amount at 85%. You could see that changed as well. There might be a level where it's inclusive as 100 or 100% includable in adjusted gross income for tax purposes.
If you have a financial situation and you're not quite sure what to do, you better call Gregory. If you have a Social Security eligibility question or strategy question, call Gregory. 504-260-0995. I'm James Parker. This is Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on Newstalk 99.5 WRNO. It's Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO. I am your co-host, James Parker. We're finally whole again. We kind of did a flip-flop there. You were out of town last week. I was out of town this week. And it feels like we got the old band back together. This is the longest I have gone without seeing you since, what, 2010?
You're probably right.
Now, we talked on the phone a couple times, a couple of text messages, a couple of emails, but actually, like, seeing you face-to-face 2 weeks in a row?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
Well, we're back in the saddle now, and I think...
So what, you were on special assignment this week?
I don't get to go on special assignments. I get sent out on mop-up duty is what I have to do. It's a little less prestigious when I'm out of town. But I know what mode we're in now. We are in put your head down and run through the world like an angry bull until Christmas mode. Because everything's starting. Baby Rex goes to first grade this week. Football season starts in 3 weeks. Then we're about to be in holiday season where it goes Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, Mardi Gras, St. Patrick's Day, and then Jazz Fest and all that. And then that's it, man. We are in game mode through I guess Christmas, right? That's our next break. That's it. No more breaks, Gregory.
Well, traffic is going to pick up in mornings and mid afternoon. We've had a break from that for a couple months. School's starting. We've got start dates rolling out. It's kind of started this week and increases, the next couple of weeks. And then we're in lines in the morning trying to get to our on ramps, off ramps, and so forth.
Angie?
I give traffic throughout the week. And it's the only time of the year I get to tell people about school zones. Remember, they're in effect. Slow down. Watch your speeds. There you go.
Thank you.
Gee, fun.
All right, next Gregory Ricks live event. We've got events lined up through the rest of the year, too. It's coming up on Tuesday, 6:30 p.m., Ruth's Chris in Metairie, and this month's charity's Team Gleason. Why is it important, Gregory, that they bring their spouse?
To our events?
Yeah.
It's just like coming into the office. They both need to be involved in what's going on, even though one partner will say, well, I defer to him or I defer to her to handle it, but you still need to know what's going on. Life at some time is going to take one of us before the other. And if you've not been connected to understand what's going on, yeah, that could be a pretty big gap there. But to understand, and part of that is, I think, one of the main things is even when a spouse doesn't want to be involved, like it's like pulling teeth to get them to come to a meeting. Well, you need to find out if they like me. If they like our firm, like how we do things, and they feel confident that they're being looked out for, then then that's good. So they don't necessarily have to come to all meetings, but, you know, they need to be involved and understand the process.
Well, you've told so many stories about you've been involved in a meeting or a consultation with some clients, and both spouses are there, and you'll ask what may be a simple question, maybe a little half complex question, but they both have different answers, and they have to talk amongst themselves and figure it out before you know what to do next.
Exactly. That does happen. Look, there was a couple on annual review that got into an argument, which surprised me.
Ooh, tell me that story.
And at some point, because he came in there all of a sudden throughout there, he's ready to retire, and he had some little bit different thinking. And I said, well, this is a complete different conversation than we had 2 years ago. And he was looking at Social Security was Lagniappe, but he wanted the assets to produce what he was earning, and that wasn't possible, and that wasn't the previous discussion. And then she got upset because they had not had that discussion beforehand. So they were going back and forth. So I just kind of pushed my chair back and said, well, do y'all need a minute? And that didn't resolve it. And I said, well, what? I'm going to call an end to this meeting for today. And what you need to do is go home, talk about this, work it out, then let me know what you want to do.
And what a pain it would have been if the spouse hadn't have been there, because then you would have made a plan that probably would have gotten rejected when he took it home, or maybe he doesn't tell her and she's really upset.
Well, if it's not going to work, it doesn't matter who's there. If it's not going to work mathematically, it's not going to work. So it wasn't going to work if it was just him there, and it wasn't going to work with both of them there. But they were not on the same page, which is rare. I'll tell you that. It's rare. They're generally in sync. Now, where would the difference be a lot of the time? Risk tolerance. They're not always in sync, but then a lot of them are. That they'll and they kind of have fun with it. They'll look at that. Well, which one did you pick? No, which one did you pick first? So,
oh, they don't get to look at each other's answer?
And then they'll talk about it.
Okay.
And really what I'm wanting is one between them, but at times his and her assets could be directed a little bit differently because of their answers.
Well, then there's also the issue. It doesn't matter who is maybe the primary charge of the finances. There's going to be some questions that the other spouse has the answer to that you don't. And so it's kind of sort of picking up the slack because one person is not going to know everything.
No, most of the time not. Well, and they'll work together to get the answers. I've got an interesting story from yesterday. And that was, and there was some disconnects on the paperwork. They said, well, we can survive on $3,000 a month in income, but they're making $135 combined now a year.
What?
And then I'm looking at their savings, and there was $10,000 in savings. A little disconnect there. Then to find out the house mortgage and truck notes, $2,000 a month. Well, that's most of the 2/3 of the $3,000 a month. Oh, and he turned on Social Security 3 years ago. And so, but we're saving that. Then I asked, well, is there another account that you don't have listed here? Because I'm not seeing it. You only have $10,000 in savings. Oh, well, we guess we're spending some of that. So you can see a lot of disconnects there, and they're both involved in that. She said, well, you know, maybe I just put down some of those answers too quickly or something to that effect. Well, how much do you spend a month? And I said, I think you're spending about $6,000 a month to get by. But what we really need is those numbers of, and what's a simple way to do that, James?
Look at your bank statements.
Look at your bank statements past 6 months. What's the inflow and outflow? That tells you right there.
I got
and
it right.
Average it. It's pretty simple. And there's a place on your statement that shows how much you've paid out and how much you took in. So you can actually get to it real quick. Because some of us say, well, we've got to make a budget. You're living your budget. What you may need to do is shift to a budget. And what we want really is to continue our lifestyle. Now, if you're wasting a lot somewhere, maybe you could think about dialing that back or getting it under control from that standpoint. But that meeting's going to continue to next month, but there's just some interesting gaps there where they're saying, well, we can do this, but the reality is, no, it doesn't look like you can.
Now that I know what the process looks like, though, I wouldn't want to do it without my spouse involved. I wouldn't want to even, if you ask me the question, are you in your retirement home? I would want to consult with the hot redhead. I don't know. Are you comfortable living here when we're 90 years old? You know,
that really is a question for both of them, because a lot of time I've seen two different answers. Well, he wants to stay here from now on, but if he goes before me, I'm moving. You know, and then sometimes, yeah, the property's too big, but we just like it there. And you get that answer different a lot of times. They'll throw in, yeah, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to be a yeah, but I don't want a house. If I'm going to be 90 years old, I'd like to live in one of these assisted living facilities. I would like to live in an assisted living facility, and I'm in my 30s. Because when I went and visited my grandmother, I was like, this is sweet. It's like you're in your condo, but there's a cafeteria downstairs where they have breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Then they have these little game rooms where they have movie night, and they have that looks awesome to me. That's what I'm looking for. Don't have to mow the grass. Don't have to take care of the air conditioner breaking. You know, that's what I'm looking forward to. I don't think the hot redhead's into it as much as I am. She's a little more independent, you know, likes to do her own thing. Not me. I'll just lean on others. But part of this is how intimate some of the questions feel, how personal the questions have to be asked for you to do your job. You need your spouse there. These are family decisions. These aren't financial decisions always.
Yeah, it isn't just about coming in there and selling stuff out of your portfolio or shifting you to ETFs or using fixed interest annuities or something like that. It's not just about that. You've got to talk about all this other stuff to help get to that. So when they're talking about rolling over some 401ks, hers in a few years, his probably in the coming months is available, his smaller. But then when I looked at what, when they both are retired, they've got six-figure, $100,000 a year coming in from Social Security, pensions, and so forth. But depending on where, and then when you figure in taxes, that's net $6,200 a month. Okay, so they've got enough money to cover that if the bills are there. But if the bills are a bit higher, then we might need to be taking some distribution from assets. Or that gap between when he retires in a few months and she retires in 4 years, because there's $5,000 in pension and Social Security benefits that she turns on. So is that gap just between his and her retirement? That's what you got to work through.
Coming up in the next hour, Wes Blanchard, a member of the Total Wealth Authority. He's our estate planning attorney. He's going to give us some insights, and we're going to discuss the difference between wills and trusts. If you have a financial or estate planning situation, you're not quite sure what to do, you better give us a call, 504-260-0995. I'm James Parker. It's Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO.
Welcome, Winning at Life, Saturday morning. You know, we do this on weeknights, too. It's called the Winning at Life, the Daily Wrap at 7 o'clock here on WRNO. But we're here till 1 o'clock, so this is hour two. You're listening to us on News Talk 99.5 WRNO. And if you're on the stream, you are using the iHeartRadio app, and you probably connected to it through the Gregory Ricks and Associates app. If you don't have that, go to your app store and download that. We have Wes Blanchard, part of the Total Wealth Authority, in here this hour with us.
Yeah, and I'm glad Wes is on board with us in our Olympic breakdown. Far too many medals in swimming. If you have a financial or estate planning question, 504-260-0995. But you're on board with this, right? Way too many swimming medals. They give out 102 swimming medals. And you were saying the guy that won the backstroke. I thought it was Michael Phelps. He didn't win the backstroke as well?
I don't think it was.
Got to do a Google search now.
I got to be 100% that it was on the backstroke. But I definitely saw a guy on Twitter yesterday, a 35-year-old American, that won a medal.
He won the 200-meter individual medley, the freestyle, the butterfly, and freestyle relay, and he picked up silver in the 100-meter butterfly.
Yeah, that's what you were talking about, Gregory, that Phelps is 31, 32 years old, still really dominating. This guy comes out, he's 35, doing a great job. And I was telling you, my wife pointed out to me early in the games that there was a 41-year-old gymnast, and I think she was from Romania, which is stunning.
What?
41 years old.
I didn't see that story. That's
incredible.
None of
the young people wanted to bother trying out, I guess.
Romania, that's a special place. Hey, did you know that this is Michael Phelps? How many Olympics has he been in?
I think this is his fifth round.
Do that math. He's 31. So what does that mean? How old was he in his first Olympics?
16?
15. He was 15. He got fifth place in the butterfly when he swam in the Olympics at age 15. And I believe,
I did not realize five. No, he should have more medals.
Well, I think that's why they were saying Ledecky had so much promise. It's because she was 15 when she won last year. So she's 19 this year, dominating, and she's on the same trajectory as Phelps is.
Yeah, she's killing it too, isn't she?
Yeah. I think she's only one medal short of what Phelps had at the same age.
Hey, guys, what were you doing when you were 15?
Not that.
Had you dedicated your life to some sort of life ambition, and you were on your way to the Olympics?
Oh, sure. I was going to play in the NBA when I was 15.
Oh, sure. Right. I was still playing Mortal Kombat. That was my big deal, making like homemade bombs in the back pasture and blowing stuff up. I was an idiot when I was 15. Can you imagine being in the Olympics?
No.
Angie, what?
Well, did you see the video of the guy from South Africa before one of the competitions was kind of messing with Phelps and being obnoxious?
Oh, Phelps was giving him the death stare.
And then he gave him the death stare.
And then
beat him.
Of course. So, but the internet loves the death stare.
Well, you have to do that. Got to beat him.
Now, what was the deal with all the hickeys? The cupping?
Yeah, so apparently that's some sort of, I guess it's akin to a quick massage therapy kind of thing. But yeah, it leaves this really weird circular bruise on you.
Okay, but this is his fifth Olympics, and he didn't do it at the previous four, he just did it this one. Because here's my theory, they're in Rio where a working lady is legal, and I don't think that's cupping. I think that might be Rio hickeys.
Very, very uniform, circular Rio.
Well, and you know why I think it doesn't help athletically? It's because I was doing it this week. I was just making the big hickeys on my shoulders here. I can't swim any faster.
Ledecky has them on her back as well, so that theory's out the window.
Well, I first saw that a few months back.
You'd seen it before?
Yeah, you know, of our triplets, Lance is the tallest and also the pitcher, and when the week he was throwing, he would go get the muscle massage and all, and he'd have these weird shapes.
Oh, look who's ahead of the curve now. I didn't know that. I didn't see that until Phelps.
I just thought it was something they did to pitchers, and I guess it's all the rage.
For everyone. When I saw it like last Sunday, I thought, oh my God, how bad are the parasites in Rio? You know, because they're swimming around in sewage water or whatever.
Yeah, was it Zika?
Zika.
Zika.
Oh, I had that 2 weeks ago. It's not that
Zika
bad.
Zika on steroids.
Yeah, the green pool's nasty. You know what that's not very good. Y'all can't keep a pool clean. Y'all can't get like some chlorine or something in Rio. What a mess that is. But I'm glad.
Hey, I didn't think it would get pulled off. So it's good that it's actually happening.
Hey, we're not done yet.
With scaffolding and everything in place.
Well, I just want to see when they start the track and field. Are they going to run 100 meters the fastest and then see who can do it the fastest backwards? And if it's ridiculous, if that sounds ridiculous, why do we accept it in swimming? If someone has 22 medals, y'all need to reform your sport. Something's going wrong there. But what about the taxation? If you get a gold medal, you're awarded $25,000, and the U.S. government taxes you on it.
They get money?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. 25 G's for a gold, but you get taxed on it. It's just counted as part of your income.
And on the Wheaties box?
Yeah, but that covers more than the $25,000. Hopefully you get a lot more than that for the Wheaties. How much does the Wheaties box pay these days?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I wasn't even close to getting on one. All right, well, thus concludes our Olympic coverage for this week. I'm sure we'll have more smart aleck remarks on the Daily Wrap coming up Monday, so stay tuned for that. Wes Blanchard, Wills versus Trust. Welcome back to the show. I know we've talked about this before, but I also know that I still don't know enough about it. Well, what brings this topic to mind this week?
Well, it's really just been sort of the pattern of questioning that I've had from clients over the last, I'd say, month or so. July was a very, very busy month for us, and in particular with Living Trust. And a lot of the conversations sort of started and went down the same particular path. And it was just more of a generalized explanation of what a trust does versus a will. But everybody obviously has a their own unique situation, but it became, you know, a little more refined once we started discussing exactly what folks were looking to do with their inheritance or how to pass it on. And so where it all starts, obviously, is, you know, the options that a trust gives you versus a will. A will, as everybody knows, is just going to it's going to be the vehicle to pass on your assets to the person or people that you'd like to pass it on to. And the one thing that we always kind of a bridge that we always have to cross is, OK, what sort of stipulations can I put on that passage, that distribution? And the answer is not many at all. Usufruct really is the most prominent one. But overall, when you pass on an item to a person or persons in a will, you can really only do it via whole ownership. So you can really just pass it on. James, I want to leave you my computer. I don't want to say I want to leave you my computer and you can't use it for 2 years. That's only something that can be done via trust. So that's the biggest sort of distinguishing factor is if you look at it, okay, now stipulations can be placed on it. A lot of times folks look at things and say, well, I have a lot of confidence in the folks that I'm leaving this money to, or maybe, you know, I'm leaving it to them and I really don't care what happens with it. I've used as much of it as I needed to in my lifetime. So it doesn't matter to me if they spend it all in a day or if they spend it in 10 years. It makes no difference to me. Other folks have obvious concerns given who they're leaving it to, whether they're financially irresponsible or maybe they're leaving it to a minor. And so when you start estate planning, and particularly for people who do it early, which is the way it should be done, you're leaving large portions of property potentially to minors. So at that point in time, you really need to put conditions on it that will hold that property, that money, that asset in trust, and allow it to be used by that person at the time that they need it most, not at the time that, you know, they're a little more prone to blowing it, you know, aka college years. So you might want to, again, give them some sort of incentive to earn that money if you're going to make it available during those college years. Or you might say, hey, actually, you know, you're gonna have to graduate altogether before you can even touch any of this. And so that's really the jumping off point, is what do you want to do with the items that you want to pass on? Do you want to put some conditions on it, or are you fine with just passing on altogether? So that's one of the main threshold questions.
So what made it so popular over the summer? Was something going on?
You know, I really
it doesn't sound like it'd be a streaky business.
Exactly. I think maybe everybody's sort of getting settled in after tax season is my best guess. But July really just was a really stacked month for us, which is great. You know, we were, of course, able to accommodate everyone. But yeah, it really just became a rush. And so that sort of concentration was what gave me a good snapshot as to, okay, what are people actually asking the most questions about? And so I know, again, like you said, it's a topic that we cover here and there. But I think every once in a while, it's good to jump back in, you know, whole body and say, okay, let's get this thing fully explored one more time.
Well, sure. But without using a trust, like if you used a will instead of a trust to leave someone a college fund, you have no way of controlling whether or not that money's even going to be spent on college, whether or not that person's going to go to college. They could go buy a Corvette and drive it into Lake Pontchartrain with the money instead of using it for tuition, right?
Correct. And that's one of the biggest motivating factors is if you have a college fund set up, or even let's say, like I said earlier, you're not paying for college necessarily. I mean, although it's not a bad idea given what's going on with TOPS nowadays, but let's say you're just saying, well, you can't access this money until afterwards. That inherently is going to give that person the motivation just to get into college. You already know it's kind of the right thing to do if you can afford it to begin with. But then at that point, you know, you're leaving money on the table if you don't go to college. And so you're making them earn that inheritance, which I think is a big deal for a lot of folks.
All right, that's Wes Blanchard. He's the estate planning attorney of the Total Wealth Authority of Gregory Ricks & Associates. Also going to be in attendance at our next Gregory Ricks live event this coming Tuesday, Ruth's Chris and Metairie, 6:30 p.m. We'll continue with this, Wills versus Trust. If you have a will or trust question, 504-260-0995. I'm James Parker. It's Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO.
Welcome back to Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks. James Parker's back in studio with me.
Yes. And we happy to be back.
Yeah. Hadn't seen him in like 2 weeks. I'm on vacation, and he had...
Not a vacation.
Not an assignment, but Buddy's back. And we have Wes Blanchard, estate planning attorney, with us as well.
Yeah, so if you have a question about wills, trust, anything financial, give us a call, 504-260-0995. We're going to go to Mike on I-10. You're next up on Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you, Mike?
Hey, I have a question. Will a trust protect my assets from creditors?
Well, Mike, that really depends first on what type of trust you have. So a revocable living trust is not going to do that. Irrevocable trust does give you that option, but there's certain conditions that need to be met in order to sufficiently, for lack of a better word, divorce you from your assets. Meaning, you know, you have to separate yourself from ownership, and that's usually done by further separating yourself from control of that asset. So when you do that, the government and the court system and things like that are going to look at that and say, well, maybe this person doesn't actually own or have any interest in this property, although he or she still may be able to receive some of that under certain conditions that are placed in the trust. They don't have sufficient control such that we ought to be able to take it away from them.
What I'm primarily trying to protect is my house. I want to, should I give it to my son now? I don't want to, you know, I don't want to lose the equity I have in it after I die to a creditor. And it's a bad situation with this creditor. It's a fight I've been going on for years, and I don't want to have them get anything.
Well, I mean, without knowing a whole heck of a lot about the situation, just from what you said now, you might be in a spot where that in any sort of transaction, especially if it's a donation, it is going to be subject to being unwound. And the reason for that is if you have a creditor and you do anything that makes you insolvent or less solvent, that transaction can be undone if the creditor were to bring you to court over it. So if you would transfer that house to your son, you would want to make sure that it is an arm's length transaction. There's fair value exchanged, because otherwise you're leaving that door open for the creditor to come in.
So basically I would have to sell it to my son.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Let me ask you a question. Is there litigation?
No, there's not been any litigation yet.
Okay. But you do owe a debt that's disputed.
I do owe a debt that I'm disputing. Yeah. And it's getting horrendously out of line with fees that they're adding to it. The debt has quadrupled now with the fees that they keep adding to it. And it's just, you know, getting ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree with Wes, though, that it's going to be difficult to try to move that value to someplace else since that's going on.
You know, and the only asset I have is my house. You know, and it's not a lot of assets, but I mean, not a lot of equity, and the equity is actually less than what they've got, what they've trumped this debt up to now.
Yeah,
you know,
see,
and I don't
want
to lose all my equity to this debt if they do eventually take me to court. You know,
and they're going to put a lien against it at some point if you lose.
Right.
If it goes to court or it's not resolved, and that's one of the places they go, so they eventually do get their money back some way, somehow.
Right.
There's a fellow I know that's got a business in South Louisiana, and he's got a building and land, and you would not believe the liens against it, but he still conducts business, goes to work every day, does what he does. I guess more a pile up, but they can't get it until he would sell it or die or something. I don't know how that would. Wes would know more about that.
Wes, how does that work? Can you just run out the clock on that?
No. So eventually.
Isn't that the financial version of running out the clock on your lien?
No. I mean, so if you have a lien on it, really what it means is it really all depends, obviously, first on what the language is. If you have a judgment, if you just have a lien and things like that. But a lien's not going to stop you from doing business.
Sure.
What they're going to say is we have the first right to any sort of liquidation or anything like that that would happen.
And they got to keep the lien up to date. So if they don't keep renewing the lien, it can't disappear.
So you could wait it out. Maybe they forget to renew it or something.
Yeah, honey, I guess we're not moving after all. This is
now, the only other choice I got would be to, I guess, take all the equity out with financing.
I don't like the sound of that.
Option I can think of.
You mean like a refi? Cash out with a refi?
Yeah, cash out.
Nah.
Yeah, I kind of saw Wes' side there a little bit. Go ahead and tell him what you're thinking, Wes.
Well, I think it sort of fell into that category that I mentioned earlier, where it's not only if it makes you insolvent, it's if it makes you less solvent. So if you do it that way, I think they have a decent argument. This is saying that you've now made yourself less solvent. You've made that asset less valuable that they have a lien on. So,
but they don't have a lien on it yet, so what's preventing me from doing that?
Well,
I can't refinance my own house if I want to.
No, I mean, I don't think refinancing is it, but I thought you were talking along the lines of doing a reverse mortgage. Maybe I heard that wrong.
I heard putting it in a trust.
I'm not old enough to borrow the equity out,
that's what he said.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Yeah, I just told him that you were talking about what if you borrowed the equity out of the house.
Right. That's what I was thinking about doing.
Which I guess a lump sum of
a trust is not going to do it.
Yeah.
Do you have an attorney that's helping you?
No, I don't. Okay. This is where you should have a
consultation. We're doing this on air, but this is not actual legal advice, but you are speaking with an attorney and he's having pause. So you should consult somebody that is going to give you advice that you would need to show up in court with at some point. If you're going to do this, I would be clear on what's coming.
Any chance you could just actually pay this debt off the old-fashioned way?
No, I can't. And with it going, like I say, going to the collection and they adding fees, it's just gotten ridiculous with the amount it's gone to. And it's just no way that I can pay it.
Sounds like you're in a tight spot. Get some professional help, Mike.
Yep.
Yeah, I am. I am. And I just can't do it. And I just, you know, would like to be able to leave my house to my son and my grandchildren when I do die, because that's the only asset that I have.
Yeah. Get some legal advice, and maybe that can get towards resolving it.
Okay. Now, do I need to talk to a real estate attorney or just a regular attorney?
Wes?
I mean, a real estate attorney is certainly going to be a good start. That would probably be your better bet. Yeah,
I think wouldn't it depend on what the debt is?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, a business law attorney is going to do great for you too. It's just more or less, you know, what angle you're looking to go. Again, we don't know a whole heck of a lot about the debt, so it might make a difference.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate you.
Right.
Good luck to you.
Yeah. Good luck's probably the best farewell to that one.
Yeah, he needs, even if the attorney redirects him to somebody else, he needs to get that conversation going to then figure out what can I do to protect this property. If there's avenues and if there's going to be more repercussions from that, he needs that. It sounds like it's headed that way. If it's in collections, goes the next part is litigation to try to get it paid.
Well, that is one of the appealing things about trust, is it can protect your assets from creditors, some assets from some creditors some of the time.
You know, and this is a good call for that reason. When you're seeing that, is when you wait till you have problems to try to protect the property, it's too late then. So when you think ahead, and that's one of the reasons to have a trust, it puts that wall up around the property, or that wall around the money as well. I've got a client, 8 figures in assets, and she, in coming into the money, there was a trust, and she had to show all this proof of being ready to take over the money, and so she has a real negative outlook on trust. And one of the things I was pointing out in a meeting the other day is why you need a trust. First and foremost, there's an estate tax, and that would affect her if she died. And the money going to her kids, it's going to be cut in half about in that case. And then the other is she doesn't want somebody to sue, you know, mess up, get sued, and get some of that money as well. What should you put around it? A trust, irrevocable trust. What was her concern? Having to jump through hoops to get to her own money. So who's in if she set up a trust, who's in charge of the trust?
She is.
She is. Is there anybody else?
Nope.
No. Would she have any problem with herself getting to the money?
No.
No. She's in total control. It's just at arm's length. Sometimes people don't understand this. It's like, oh, that's complicated. Really, it's not. It's just you put it at arm's length. You put a wall around the money. And if you're wanting to buy a property, you put a trust around. That's what I mean, the wall around the money, irrevocable trust, or the real estate should be in probably some entity, LLC, or even a trust as well.
Hey, Wes, were you with us when we talked about this guy who left $20 million to his two daughters, but he put all kinds of strings on it last year? This is our favorite trust story. I don't think you were on that episode. Let's review some of that, because we learned so much about that last year. I'll run it by you next. If you have a question like Mike did, 504-260-0995. I got Wes Blanchard, the estate planning attorney of the Total Wealth Authority in studio, along with Gregory Ricks. I'm James Parker. This is Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO.
Life with Gregory Ricks is copyrighted by Gregory Ricks for the private use of our audience. Any unauthorized use of this broadcast without express consent by Gregory Ricks is prohibited.
Welcome back to Winning at Life on News Talk 99.5 WRNO and the iHeartRadio app. We'll have to check my emails, see if we've received any messages from the app or email questions or from site chat at gregoryricks.com. Just want to point out that story I shared, I've had that many times in similar situations there. And people don't realize when they come into that kind of money, and it happens quite frequently. I was going to say all the time. It's not all the time, but we have these types of discussions where they don't realize the exposure or that there's that type of federal tax at death on assets. So, you know, if you come into $10 million, you know, it can be quite expensive. And then just it, and you have the personal liability if you hit somebody, run over somebody, kill somebody, you know, it can get quite expensive because it could go beyond your coverages. And that's one reason to have umbrella liability coverage and then have proper structuring. IRAs have a protection that are built in up to $1 million, 401ks as well from a federal standpoint. But when people come into money, whether it's settlements, inheritance and such, it's typically non-qualified that we see in these larger amounts. So it doesn't have the IRA protection. So then they have to think about structuring, and going back to that caller is where you might want to be proactive, because you just can't never tell. And it really isn't that expensive. So when you think of, let's just say a trust costs $2,000 to do it, hypothetically, which would be more expensive? The litigation you're about to go through, or the peace of mind that, yeah, you can't squeeze blood out of a turnip, right?
Right. No, I think that's 100% true. And it sounds a little ridiculous, but that's the planning part of estate planning. It does take time to plan ahead. It's not always easy. It's easy to procrastinate on it. But again, it's a lot like the power of attorney situation that we talk about all the time. You can't get a power attorney when you need it. You need to get a power attorney before you need it.
Right.
Yeah, so, it is. It's advanced planning.
Right. And so that's what you're looking to do. So you need to make sure that you're ready, that you have that contingency all sewn up, so that if and when something unexpected strikes, you're sitting pretty. You're ready to roll.
You got to remember that line. We might put that on your tombstone. You can't get a power of attorney when you need it. You have to get it before you need it. Yeah.
We had a situation come up last year on that where the gentleman had a power of attorney but once it was put into the trust, the power of attorney didn't cover that because he wanted to reposition how the money was managed and couldn't do so. He said, well, I had the power to put it in there. Yes. And then that took it away from your authority. So he was wanting instruction of how to fix that. There was no fix, was there?
No, there really wasn't. I think ultimately we were able to work with it a little bit, but yeah.
Well, money had to go back.
Correct.
Where it was and stay in that situation, which is fine. He just, it's the realizing, uh-oh, I've lost some control in that. So, and that wasn't his fault. He had obviously had a power attorney. It was written up, but there was gaps. Mm-hmm. And that's some of the stuff we look out for. You look out for as well. When we see others' mistakes, it's easy to learn from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's definitely something you want to keep an eye out for, is as your estate plan grows, it needs to grow as a whole. It can't just grow as, you know, as one branch shooting out from the tree. They kind of all have to be on the same page, if you will. So I think in his situation, it seemed as if he had a power of attorney that was drawn up probably before the trust was in effect. And as such, it didn't include language in the power of attorney that would allow him to control the trust. And then vice versa as well. The trust didn't have language that allowed it to be controlled via a separate power of attorney. So because there was no matching language, there was just this gap that you said, the inability to cross that bridge and get what he needed to get done.
Yeah, like, and that example came up because our custodian is Fidelity Investments, and I don't know about other firms, but they're wanting to look at that. We need to see the trust, or we want to see the power of attorney to see if the language in there, because they're going to have their people look at it. They're not going to let something go by just because you say, well, yeah, I've got one, I want to move it. That's not going to fly. They're going to look at the documents.
All right, we got Wes Blanchard in studio. If you have a estate planning or financial situation, not quite sure what to do, 504-260-0995. Now, Gregory, I know you'll remember this story. Wes, you got to check this out. Stories for less analytical people, they call us creative. I think it's scatterbrained is what it should be called. Stories really drive home and kind of send a message or give you an idea of what these trusts are capable of. And we told a story last summer on the show about this wealthy landlord in Manhattan. He's sort of a socialite guy, and he has tons of money. But most of it, when he died, he left a charity, but he set aside $20 million for his two daughters. Now, they don't get $20 million. And the concerns you said in the first segment of this hour, where you have no control over where they spend it. They could just go blow it on a vacation or buy a yacht and sink it. And he wanted to have a little more control, and he wanted to use this money as a force for good to incentivize his daughters to behave properly. So he put it in a trust, and his two daughters, one's 21, one's 17 at the time of death last year, they get $500,000 for tying the knot when they get married, but only if the husband signs a sworn statement, I guess sort of like a prenup, promising that he can't spend any of the money, and he's not allowed to have any influence over how it's spent. None of it can be spent on him or by him. Another condition, the daughter gets another $750,000 out of, each of them got the $10 million trust. They get $750,000 if they graduate from an accredited university, and then they have to write 100 words or less describing what they intend to do with the funds. And he appointed a trustee that's supposed to actually grade the paper and find out if it's acceptable. And he gave that guy instructions. You know, if she says, I'm going to go backpacking in the eastern Syrian desert, say no. Both daughters get a big incentive to earn decent salaries by 2020. They will receive an annual payout of three times the income listed on their personal federal tax returns. And the check's going to be cut on April 15th every year.
Nice.
So if they go out, he doesn't want them to be a barista, scoring $25,000 a year. You're going to go to college. You're going to get a job, and you're going to get a good job. You're going to get a good paying job, because if you can make $100,000, you're going to get another $300,000 on top of that. Or wait, is that the, three times the annual income listed. Right. If the daughters have kids and don't work outside the house, if they're homemakers, the trustees will each give them 3% of the value of their trust every January 1st. So, I mean, that's going to be a pretty big score. That'll be a few hundred thousand bucks. But only there's one catch. The money only goes to the daughter if the kid is born in wedlock. So these are things that when this story came out, I had no idea the flexibility of the trust, and they could be this intricate and that specific. And you're incentivizing your daughter to not have kids out of wedlock, to only have them in wedlock. This is all brilliant stuff. The sisters could also, and this is a nice little loving thing he did, the sisters could also earn the same amount, that 3% off the total value of the trust, if something happens to their mother and they are the caregiver for the mom.
Okay.
So if take care of your mom. If you have to quit your job to take care of your mom, I can supply the funds for that, and that'll come out of the trust. Now, the mom's only 58, so she's not like on death's door. She's got a long time to go. But, he's thinking ahead. I mean, that's what, 2-3 decades into the future, he's thinking, after he's gone, this money is still going to be controlling the actions in a very positive way of his family. Now, the last little bullet point here, and Gregory, don't answer this. I'm going to ask Wes. Guess how much the wife gets?
Dollar figure, $5 million.
It's less than that.
Less than that?
Yeah.
Jeez, Pete. 1.5.
She gets nothing. They were in the middle of a divorce. Nothing. She tried to contest it, but you can't touch it, apparently. They were in the middle of a divorce. She had signed a prenup, divorcing herself, no pun intended, from, you know, community property rights. Mm-hmm. And the prenup is going to stand combined with the trust. She gets nothing. This is all for the daughters. That wife that they were in the middle of divorce, they were going through the process. Nothing. How brilliant. Does everyone just love this guy or what? Is he sort of an estate planning hero in your terms? You should probably have a little statue of this guy on your desk.
Well, he did a really good job, and the attorney that he was working with, clearly, you know, they sat down and he laid out his objectives, and they came up with some creative ways to achieve those objectives, which is really great. And, you know, even though he didn't leave his wife anything, he still left his daughters 3% to go care for her in the event that she becomes ill or anything.
He doesn't want her dead. He just doesn't want her to enjoy the money. Now, hang on a second. We're about to have to take a break. But, hey, Patrick and Hammond, you're next up on Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks. But we're going to have to do something here. You got 1 minute to ask your question. We'll take a two-minute break, and then we'll come back and get the answer from Wes. All right, Patrick, what's your question?
Hey, my father-in-law has set up an irrevocable trust in New York State with two properties in it. And he recently moved down to Florida, and we moved into New Orleans, and we went to apply for a mortgage on our new purchase. They included his property in the irrevocable trust as a liability as far as taxes. Is that normal? Is that common? We had to prove that we were able to cover the taxes for the property that was in the trust.
Interesting. All right, that's a tough one, Patrick. We're going to need you to answer in just about 2 minutes here. If you want to be next, 504-260-0995. I'm James Parker. This is Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks, and we also got Wes Blanchard, estate planning attorney in studio. It's News Talk 99.5 WRNO. Ain't it fun? Hey, welcome to Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO. I'm your co-host, James Parker. Gregory Ricks is in studio. Also, we're joined by Wes Blanchard, the estate planning attorney of the Total Wealth Authority of Gregory Ricks & Associates. And he will be at our Gregory Ricks Live event coming up this Tuesday, Ruth's Chris in Metairie. I believe we have like four chairs available, so if you want to reserve your seat for that, go to GregoryRicks.com, the Gregory Ricks & Associates app. Or you can do the old-fashioned thing and call. Remember when people used to always call? 504-832-9200. I almost get upset when people call and it's like a two-sentence call. It's like, you should have just texted that. Like when you have a meeting these days, that should have been an email.
Yeah.
Yeah, that the whole meeting should have been an email. Feel the same way. Patrick in Hammond was asking Wes what I thought was a complicated question, Patrick, but talking to him on the break here, he's like, no, this is pretty cut and dry stuff, Parker. So Patrick is going to be the beneficiary of some property that's currently in a trust, and the taxes on that were considered a liability when you were getting or attempting a mortgage here in New Orleans. Is that a fair summary of your question, Patrick?
Yes, and as well as in the event, you know, when he does pass, will we still be, I mean, honestly, I don't know if we can take the money from the trust to pay for the taxes, or do we have to put it in, or how that's covered?
Sure. That last segment there is really going to be dictated by the language of the trust. For the most part, it's, in my experience, standard fare to have that option available for you to take that and pay it. With that said, it does seem to me a pretty cut and dry situation from a mortgage company perspective. When you look at it, again, I think it's what I was telling Parker on the break is it's probably a question that can give you a little more detail from Dwayne Stein, who's going to be on next hour, because he's going to know what they're looking for as a mortgage company as far as liability goes. But yeah, I mean, you know, the problem is the tax liability and things like that. So if you're out there on the hook for it, the mortgage company is certainly going to want to know what potential you have you know, to pay out on especially something in New York, which I would imagine the taxes are going to be significantly higher.
Yeah, and so my first question for Wes Patrick was, if there's a piece of property in a trust, who's responsible for the taxes? The dude who put it in there, the beneficiaries, the trust itself, and what was the answer to that?
Well, it depends on exactly what the property's doing. So if the property's accumulating income, for instance.
Like if you own a hotel or rental property?
Right, okay. And so you're sitting there now with, does that money that the hotel's generating, is that given out to the beneficiaries immediately? Then the beneficiaries are taxed. But that's why we always talk about with irrevocable trust, when they hold money, they get into that highest tax bracket so fast. I think it's if they hold over $12,500, they're already at the highest tax bracket. So it kind of correlates to your question in that regard, where if they're holding the money and it's being, or they're holding the property and it's being assessed at a value, then as a beneficiary of that property, it's assuming it's going to flow to you, you and then in turn are going to be responsible for those taxes. So that's why it's considered a liability for you.
Do you know how it's set up? Do you have to cut a tax check every year for the property and the trust, Patrick?
Not yet. They've been, since he's still alive, he's been cutting the tax check right now. So I just, and I appreciate you answering that. That clarified it, and thanks a lot. No.
No problem, Patrick.
Thanks, Patrick. Yeah, I thought that was going to be complicated too. So. Glad it helped, Patrick. All right, so Wes Blanchard, let's talk about our Gregory Ricks Live coming up on Tuesday. Some of the questions you get asked, frequently asked questions to Wes Blanchard. What do you hear a lot?
I do hear a lot about wills. That's generally the opening question is what do I do? What can and can I not put in a will? Frankly, what I hear a lot is how do I stop somebody from challenging my will? That's one of the more common ones at these events for one reason or the other. Not
because wills
sure
always get challenged.
Yeah, and that's kind of the answer that I have to give them a lot. Is you know, I wish I had a great answer for you, but anybody can always, you know, give it a shot. Of course, it's going to cost some money, so you want to disincentivize that as much as possible. But you really can't stop someone from giving it a go. Yeah, you can make it less attractive. And you can do that via trust or via will. Trusts are a lot more difficult to challenge, but that doesn't mean a challenge can't be surmounted. So that's one of the more common ones.
Well, can you put a clause in the will that says if anyone challenges the will, they get $1?
So, yeah, and that's actually that's part of the wills that I always draft up. It's called a contest clause, and it's a lot more complicated than that. We have a large list of actions that if you're deemed an heir in the will and you take on one of these 13 or 14 activities that essentially you're trying to cut down on the mandates of the will or challenge the will in any way, you lose your inheritance right off the bat if you're unsuccessful. Now, of course, if you're successful, well, then, you know, the judge is going to say, well, obviously that clause is not, you know, valid because you successfully challenged what should have been something different. But if you take a shot at it as an heir and you lose your entire right to your inheritance. So obviously you're looking at it from that perspective and saying, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze at this point? And, you know, most of the time it's going to be no. You just take what they leave you and move on.
Dude, you like that saying? Is the juice worth the squeeze? Is that something they taught you in law school, Wes?
No.
That's a new one to me. You've really? Heard that?
I've never heard that, but that was pretty smooth.
I don't know. I mean, that one's pretty common to me. If my wife was listening right now, she'd tell you I come up with things all the time.
You just made that up, didn't you?
I didn't make that up, but I can't say that I haven't tried to make up other
things. Let me put that in my note.
I got a pen for you right here, bud.
I'm putting it in my note on my iPhone. Yeah.
See, I have to make up euphemisms all the time on the radio because you're not allowed to say dirty stuff.
Right.
So whenever I'm talking about something that's like forbidden from the FCC, anything you say coming out of a middle-aged white guy, it just sounds creepy. So it's like, yeah, I'd like to take her home and rotate her tires, if you know what I'm saying, guys. And that's totally innocent, but that's how I get away with saying questionable stuff. But you could do it anything. I'd like to clean her fish tank. You know, it just anything sounds dirty if you say it like that.
Yeah.
So is the juice worth the squeeze? See, we're learning a lot from Wes here. Gregory, he's not just an estate planning guy, but just a wealth of idiomatic phrases. Okay, so let's talk about what's coming up on Tuesday. When you're in front of the crew, you know, Dwayne has the great little two-part question. He says, how many of you own your home? almost everyone raised their hand. How many of you in your retirement home? And the participation drops. If you had one question you would ask the whole group, don't say how many of y'all have a will. What would your question be?
What is your plan to pass on your assets?
Nice and vague, but that can't be settled with a hand raise.
No, I mean, I didn't realize I was getting a responsive hand raise out of it. I would say I'd probably have to come up with something that's sort of a yes or no question, because that's kind of what you're looking in that direction. But yeah, that's the main thing, is you really just want to get a plan set up. Or do you have a plan? Do you have a written plan? That might be the first step for you, because it's, you know, this word of mouth of telling your brother what you want to do when you leave all your assets to him.
Never works. How,
yeah, I mean, you know, you're leaving too much wiggle room, you know, and it doesn't have to be that way. It just doesn't. You know, what I always say in these seminars is, you know, a good estate plan is a capstone to a good financial plan. And that's why Gregor and I work together, is it's part of the entire picture. So, you know, and the rest of the Total Wealth Authority fits in the exact same way. We're big picture. And that's the advantage that we give you.
Well, there's a couple of things that Gregory Ricks has in his general umbrella, because, you know, we cover all aspects of your financial well-being, where we basically have to rope you in. If someone's going to get a reverse mortgage, you have to reevaluate your estate plan. That changes everything. What are some of the other little tripwires where Wes Blanchard becomes a guy we have to call?
Well, the one that I think we run into all the time is the IRAs. When we talk about how people would like to pass on their IRAs, do they want to do it via trust, or do they want to do it...
Like the IRA pass-through trust or
inheritance
trust?
Correct, by leaving it to an individual. And so, generally speaking, most of the time what you'd like to do is just leave it to an individual. And we've talked several times about why that is. You can use the stretch-out provision, and that's the biggest tax-deferring reason that you want to leave it to an individual rather than a trust. However, there are certain situations where you want to leave it to an individual, but you want to have stipulations on it, and so you'd like to have a trust as the beneficiary. Trust, again, would name that particular person as its beneficiary. However, there are certain stipulations that need to be covered in that trust before that happens. A lot of times, once you get into the inner workings, you realize that, hey, maybe it's not a path that I want to go down. Maybe I am okay with, you know, having it left to a particular person and then trusting them to say, wait, I get a few more bucks if I just do it this way, rather than taking the big lump sum and the inherent tax cut right away at the front. So we do see that a lot, for sure.
Good deal. All right. Well, Wes, we only have 2 minutes, so I don't want to start a whole nother line of questioning, but I know you're a big football fan.
Yeah.
We're in training camp season here. We should be in preseason, but the Hall of Fame game got canceled, and then the one that was supposed to be in New York got canceled yesterday. I think the Dolphins and Giants were supposed to play a preseason game, and the weather was so nasty. They had lightning, and they were shocked. Apparently, they don't have lightning in Yankee Stand. They were like, we can't play under such conditions. It may rain, and there's lightning everywhere. But how do you think the Saints are going to do?
I tell you what, I was encouraged with the pressure that the defensive line was getting, and I really was encouraged by Michael Thomas, the wide receiver out there, the rookie. He looks like he might be ready to step in. And
when did
really,
you see him?
Well, he played on Thursday. He had a couple really big catches. He's a 6'3" guy, really, you know, physical. Kind of the guy that you can throw the ball in the air and know that he's going to go really give it a shot to go get it.
That's like the opposite of Brandon Cooks. What a perfect compliment, because he's the little speed demon.
Hit the nail in the head.
Yeah.
Yep.
Beautiful. And Drew Brees, he's still got like 5 good years left?
I would say at least 4, that's for sure.
All right, there he is, Wes Blanchard, our estate planning attorney. He will be at our live event coming up this Tuesday, 6:30 p.m., Roost Chris in Metairie. Come on out. You've been saying you need to get your money in order. Well, this is what you had in mind. Gregory Ricks Live coming up Tuesday. Come meet the crew. I'll be there, Gregory. Dwayne Stein, who's going to do Mortgage Gumbo at 1 o'clock, will be there. And Wes Blanchard, the estate planning attorney. So thank you very much for your time, Wes. We'll do it again soon.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, we're going to continue with the financial goodness. If you have a financial situation and you're not quite sure what to do, you better call Gregory, 504-260-0995. I'm James Parker. You're listening to Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks on News Talk, 99.5 WRNO.
Welcome to Winning at Life.
I'm your host, Gregory Ricks, the 401k and Retirement Authority. This is hour three here of live radio. If you have a financial situation you'd like some help with, the phone number is 504-260-0995. You can go to gregoryricks.com. We have a site chat. We emails gregory@gregoryricks.com or use your Gregory Ricks and Associates app to send us a message.
All right. We got some more financial goodness coming up. If you have a financial situation, not quite sure what to do, give Gregory a call like Frank and Slidell just did. What's up, Frank? You're next up on Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks. How can we help you?
Hey, good afternoon, maybe good morning. But you guys okay, I'm sure, huh?
Doing well. I'm glad it rained and cooled things off.
Yeah, no, boy, that's a good thing. You're right.
It's really
like
done
those, 80s. Uh-huh. 80 degrees. But I was calling up, sir, out of curiosity. I mean, I'm curious. And I've never heard this discussed, and, well, I mean, maybe I don't catch every radio show. But on a reverse mortgage, if a single person with no beneficiaries, no dependents, and they take a reverse mortgage, is that a good thing? I mean, cause I kind of understand that if that person that takes the reverse mortgage passes away, the family is responsible for something in there. I'm not sure. But I mean, on a single person without a family, have you ever heard a question like that before?
No, I've not heard this question this way before, but I've never heard of you doing a reverse mortgage and somebody else inherits the liability of that. Here's what happens. If you are leaving it, say you have a son and you're leaving the property to him, your savings account, your CDs, and whatever else, the gold watch, you're leaving it to him. But on that house you're leaving to him, there's a reverse mortgage and 75% of the equity is used up. So there is 25%, or he could just say, look, bank, you've got this. He doesn't have to inherit the property.
And, well, I understand, but what I'm questioning or my curiosity is if there's no one to even make a will for and you do reverse mortgage, where does it go? Or is that good for that person that, you know, that takes the mortgage? I mean, it's reverse mortgage.
They're basing it on you, not anybody else, not any heirs or beneficiaries.
Correct.
And that won't prevent you from doing a reverse mortgage.
I think what he's trying to say, Frank, is it's good regardless of whether or not you have. That has very little effect on whether or not a reverse mortgage is right for your situation, whether or not you have kids. I think what you're thinking about, and this is my guess, is the liabilities that could be left to the kid is if they want to keep the house, then they would have to make the bank whole for the money that they lent you, because they don't just give you the money. It's they're lending you the money.
Correct.
Right. So if they want to keep the house, then they would be on the hook to make the bank whole. But usually kids don't want the house. They're living somewhere. They already got a house.
But this is what I'm getting at. Like, there is no children to let the house to.
So this may make a reverse mortgage more attractive to you, but it doesn't become unattractive if you do have heirs. Is that the right way to phrase it, Gregory?
Okay. Exactly. It doesn't matter either
way. The last question is, I pass away and there's a reverse mortgage on the house. The bank just keeps the house?
Well, they're going to sell the house and resolve the debt that's on the house.
Right. So, okay, I think that's kind of what I was inquiring about. But, yes, it would go toward the financial institute that did the reverse mortgage or the bank as it is. But, yep. Hey, thanks a lot, guys.
Okay.
Thanks for listening, Frank. Glad you called. Always a new question. So, did Wes say something that sparked your interest over here? Because I see you flipping through the Ed Slott book.
Oh, yeah. I was ready to pull out my notes regarding trust, IRA inheritance trust, because he brought that up. That is a question we get a lot, is because IRAs are named beneficiaries, is what it goes by, the named beneficiary. And if you're not wanting, and let's say you do have $1 million IRA, are you wanting it to go to that? You know, is there some lack of trust there that they'll handle it correctly? Any number of reasons, but you can't rename an IRA to be owned by a trust or pass the money into a trust to hold it. Those are taxable events. You have to use a pass-through trust to handle that. And so there's, and we've covered this a few weeks back or several weeks back, but there's a whole lot of rules you need to look out for that. And the key to it, it has to be a look through or see through trust for IRA distribution purposes. The trust must meet certain requirements. First, the trust is valid under state law, or would be, but for the fact that there is no corpus. It doesn't hold anything in it. The trust is irrevocable, or the trust contains language to the effect it becomes irrevocable upon the death of the employee or IRA owner. Third, the beneficiaries of the trust who are beneficiaries with respect to the trust's interest in the employee or IRA owner's benefit are identifiable. So this is following for both whether it's a 401k or IRA. And the required trust documentation has been provided by the trustee of the trust to the plan administrator no later than October 31st of the year following the year of the IRA owner's death. And in addition, the above requirements, all trust beneficiaries must be individuals, or there will be no designated beneficiary on the IRA and the trust option will be lost. You can't stretch it, so it means it has to be cashed out within 60 months.
Man, that sounds so complicated.
So that's just what came to my mind when you brought that up at the end of last hour. Oh, yeah, it's complicated. But if there's a need for it, there's a way to do it. And the reason we covered it probably it was last month, I guess, is had a client situation come through and they called wanting to change the beneficiaries to a trust, which raises red flags. And it turns out the attorney was not doing it right, which is typically the case. Now, they think they totally understand it, and he, you know, it's PLR rulings and all that. Well, I know those rulings too, but what caught my attention is when I asked them, is it a revocable or irrevocable trust? And they said, well, it's a revocable trust. Then it's not valid. So you think all this is taken care of, and then both of you die, and then it becomes a taxable event, and you didn't know that it was not done right.
Sometimes you need an estate planning attorney. Sometimes an estate planning attorney needs you.
Yeah. That's why we work as a team.
Did you have a recent story that came up that made you think of that?
Well, I did a couple months ago. I can't remember the time, but we had covered it extensively through the notes here. I've got pages and pages of it, but you can go back to that show. It was pretty detailed.
Well, I like the when you say whoever is going
might
to have
been that last time you were out. I don't remember.
Whenever... whoever owns an IRA has to be able to die.
Yeah. Yeah. It has to be an individual. You have to be able to turn 70 and a half. You have a mortality table, actuarial table of life. LLC doesn't have that. A corporation doesn't have that. A trust doesn't have that. When's that trust going to be 77 and a half? When is that trust going to die?
Yeah, it's not.
Not.
I just like the way, because, you know, professionally phrasing it, it'd be like, you have to have an actuarial table. No, it has to be able to die. It has to be able to bleed, and it has to be able to die. Like in Predator, if it can bleed, it can die. Hey, so we had an advancement on the local front here in the business world, something, because we only have a couple minutes left in the segment, and this is a quickie. Short-term rentals were dealt with by the New Orleans Planning Commission. Now, this isn't a final change in the rules.
Sure sounded like it.
Well, the commission's vote is a recommendation to the city council. The city council still has to give final approval, but they voted 8-1 to legalize owner-occupied short-term rentals and allow homeowners to rent out their whole homes, but only for 30 days out of the year. So this is kind of a nice compromise, because when we have these big events like a Super Bowl or a Mardi Gras or a Jazz Fest, we literally don't have enough hotel rooms to lodge everyone that wants to come here, and this fills in the slack. And if we don't allow them to fill the slack, we lose tourism, we lose dollars overall. But only 30 days. You can't be doing it year round, Gregory.
So what is the rule there, approving or disapproving again? What's the wording? And that had to do with short-term rentals.
Short-term rentals, so it's the Airbnb, renting out the whole home. Now, if you just want to rent out like an extra room in your home, that's not what's being addressed here. But if you want to allow the entire house to be rented out all year round, they consider that you're converting it to a vacation rental. And That's a big problem, because that's most of the rentals that are on Airbnb and HomeAway and VRBO. There's many of these websites
now. What are they allowing?
30 days. 30 days for those whole home rentals.
Well, mine's capped at 14.
You're going to have to explain that. That's an inside joke. And I like it, but you have to explain it.
Yeah, because I can rent it out for 14 days without it being reportable income to the IRS.
There you go. So that's a step in the right direction. I'm not sure if this will work out, because I think most of the people, what are you going to do the other 335 days a year that you can't rent out that whole home? Is it just going to sit there and collect dust? You just going to sit there and pay the taxes on it? That makes it a not viable proposition anymore. So while I think this would work in the idea of, sure, we'll have at least 30 days for people to rent these out, they're going to go away because you can't afford to have it sit vacant the other 11 months out of the year.
Well, it should be a rental property.
Were you going to kick your leasees out for 30 days a year? It's a tough one, isn't it?
We'll talk more about this after the break.
504-260-0995. I'm James Parker. This is Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO. Tell me what you want to hear.
Welcome back to Winning at Life, which this is the Saturday version. We do it Monday through Friday at 7, right here on News Talk 99.5 WRNO. And I'm your host, Gregory Ricks, James Parker, co-host. And right before we went to break, I was debating this ruling, but he says, well, you can only do it if it's short term. Well, what if I don't want to do it short term? I want to rent it few days at a time, 7 days at a time, but I want to do it throughout the year. I understand. Okay, you can only do it for 30 days, but I want to do. So where's the rule that allows me to do that?
Okay, so if you still want to treat it like an Airbnb rental, are being treated now in the black market, but be brought to light, you have to go get a license from the City Department of Safety and Permits. If you're going to do it all year, you have to get a commercial permit. I think you may have some zoning issues there as well. But then you're going to be taxed and regulated just like a bed and breakfast would be. So it's coming out of the black market. The city gets its cut of the scratch that they're missing now.
And that probably is a core reason there. Of course, public safety, make sure it's a good place for them to rent. But then you're probably going to, as you said there, the real key right there, you've got to change over to a commercial property zoning.
I think the flaw here is, if you want to keep doing it on the temporary basis, and if you want to follow that less than 30 days out of the aggregate, out of the total year, you still have to go get a permit for that. Now, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to expose yourself to taxes and regulations and let the city even know that you're doing it if you're going to do it for such a short period of time?
Well, I'm wanting to do it throughout the year.
Yeah.
Just a short period of time. But that's, I don't know. It's just the world changes and at a fast pace. And
the city's trying to figure out how they get their cut going forward.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing with the Uber and Lyft and such as that, that whole new technology that has changed the playing field on that. And that's why there's so much difficulty, because they see the shift and they're getting a piece of the other pie. And where's our piece of this one?
You know, that's a great comparison, because if you are going to have a bed and breakfast and be above board, you have to go through a condition use permitting process, submit yourself to inspections, pay these taxes, get these licenses, keep them updated. It's not really worth the hassle. I think a lot of this is going to stay on the black market. They're trying to figure out a way to do it. Hey, city council, stop fighting it. You know, try and figure out a way to work with them instead of trying to shovel them through your tax turnstile.
Yeah, it's old school trying to deal with the new technology.
Fun stuff. There's three categories here, but they want you to get a permit and let the city know about all of them. The accessory one is when you just rent out a space. If you're going to rent out an extra room, or you have a mother-in-law apartment, or you're in a shotgun double and you want to rent out the other half. Temporary, those are the people who rent your house, the whole house, up to 30 days a year. And then if you're going to go beyond that, you have to get a commercial license, a commercial permit. Short-term rentals and houses and condos in commercial areas. kind of making it too complicated. Just figure out a way to go to... They should go to Airbnb.com and say, listen, if someone's in our municipality, you're going to have to tack on a 5% tax and give us a cut, maybe. Maybe I think maybe they should address that through Airbnb rather than the property owners. All right.
I agree, because that really gets you in that case.
Did I print you a copy of this one? Look for this article, because I thought this was a nice, dry, objective, nonpartisan side-by-side comparison of the tax brackets proposed now. Now that we have both of the candidates on the record as what their proposals are, not just talking about it and answering questions in interviews, but actually issuing these papers and these reports, we can look at the tax brackets proposed by Trump and the tax brackets proposed by Hillary Clinton. And they're not really that much different, Gregory. These two candidates, they must do the same sort of poll testing and market research and come up with similar conclusions on this is what would be considered politically popular. So what do you think about this? Donald Trump, little simpler, 4 tax brackets, but Hillary only has 5 tax brackets, and they both are capping for most of us.
I thought she said she was raising taxes.
She is raising taxes.
But there's not a max tax bracket on here. What'd they do? She's showing reduction in taxes.
Oh, look, there's a little scroll bar. I don't have the top rate. That one got cut off. Oh. That was my mistake. But something else that's not listed on here is the surtax that would be on that top tax bracket. That top tax bracket, I believe she's going to leave it at 39.6%. But if you make more than, where's that surtax part? Wow, this is such a long article. If you make more than X amount of dollars a year, there's another 4%, 4.2%, I believe, was tacked on top of that. Now, the other interesting part is this chart here, how your paychecks would change after the election. You see this one? Above zero is Donald Trump. Below zero is Hillary Clinton. And for some reason, the printout cut off this part of the line. So just imagine this part's grayed out, too. See, I just colored it in. So that's what it looks like, Gregory. So for almost everyone... Actually, for everyone that pays taxes, they're going to have a little bit more in their check on Donald's Trump plan, but it goes up dramatically once you get to the top about 99% of taxpayers, even as a percentage goes. But those are the people who are really getting soaked right now. So if you go easy on them, it's going to be big. Hillary Clinton, though, you give her some credit. No one's taxes are even going to go up any until you get to the 95th percentile. And then it really shoots up for that top 2%, or shoots down, I should say. Their actual income per check is going to go down about 10% for the top income earners. But other than that, they don't really look that much different, though, do they?
No.
So if you're right in the middle brackets on the Hillary Clinton tax plan, you're going to pay either 25 or 28%. If you make if you're a single filer making between $37,000 and $91,000 a year, which is probably a big chunk of the folks listening, 25%. If you're between 91 and 190,000, 28%. So that's the totality of the middle class right there. If you're married, then that would jump up to households that bring in between 75 and 231. You're either going to pay 25 or 28%. So that's not too different than what we have now. But Donald Trump is promising to go a little bit lower for you. For our middle class buddies out there, let's say between 50 and 150 in for single filers, you would pay 20% under Trump. So that's a nice little 5% discount. If you're a married filer, though, that would be 100,000 to 300,000. You would pay 20%. If you're as a married filer in a household that makes a little less than that, between $50,000 and $100,000, 10%. Now, that's a significant reduction right there. But that's sort of the middle of the middle class. A little bit cheaper for Trump, but still Hillary. Those aren't giant. There's no giant tax hikes under the Hillary plan until you get to that top 1% or 2%. So doesn't it bother you when they come out with plans that are so similar? It's like, well, how am I supposed to decide who to vote for on this issue? You know, I wish it would have been a little more helpful if they could have put some distance between themselves. Homer in Gulfport. Hey, we know this guy, Gregory. You're next up on Winning It Live with Gregory Riggs. How can we help you, Homer?
Hey, guys. Look, I'm trying to help my brother out, and I've asked a question before. It's on Social Security, and we were talking yesterday. His wife is fixing to turn 62. Now, I know the final suspend none of us qualify for it. So his wife is fixing to turn 62 in October. She was wanting to turn on her Social Security. Well, he's going to be full age and turn his on in about 4 years. But he's under the impression that she can't turn hers on without him turning his on. And I think he may be mixed up, or either I am, about it being just hers or spousal.
She can turn.
My question is, if she turned hers on now and started drawing, I know she gets the haircut at 62, but now when he gets full retirement and turns his on, does she have the opportunity to go spousal and collect half of his?
Yes, if the spousal is larger than hers.
And there would be no haircut involved since she turned on at 62 for hers, correct?
Yeah, the haircut would continue through when she switches to the spousal benefit.
So, in other words, let's just say, okay, she's collecting $500 a month. When he turns on, say he's collecting $1,200 a month. She changes over, would she get $600 a month off of him?
Yes, 50% spousal benefit. So if hers would increase, she would be able to switch to that.
But she would carry over that 29% haircut, and that would be applied to the $600?
Yes, just like it would be applied to the $500.
So she would really be bringing home about $400 and some change.
Oh, okay. So that haircut would apply to when she changed over to spousal.
Correct.
Okay. That answers it. That clears it up. I can give him the message.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Homer. Glad to help. Good to hear from you, bud. All right. If you want to be next, 504-260-0995. We'll continue with the financial discussions coming up. And we have to talk a little bit more about the Gregory Ricks Live event coming up. And I'd love to hear from you. See how easy it is? We just helped Homer there from Gulfport. And what did that take, 2 minutes? Just a little bit of your time. Get some of your financial questions answered. I'm James Parker. You're listening to Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO.
The contents of this show are meant for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to take place of your attorney, accountant, tax professional, personal trainer, football coach, interior decorator, or those fortune tellers at Jackson Square. Please consult a financial advisor before making all investment decisions. Now, back to Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks.
Gregory Ricks & Associates is a registered investment advisory firm. If you'd like a copy of Form ADV, call the office, 504-832-9200, or go to gregoryricks.com. Reason I have to announce that, we're a licensed fiduciary and have to make that document available to you. Plus, we want to as well. And yeah, I like to brag about being a fiduciary.
Well, it's not bragging. It's just your job now.
Well, yeah, it is, and proud of it.
Yeah, Drew Brees doesn't brag about being a quarterback. He's just a quarterback. That's his bit. That's what he does. So we talked about the raise that we've gotten in the last year, and that's from gas prices going down. You know, the price of oil sank like a rock 2 years ago, and it took a while, but that finally translated into lower gas prices at the pump. Now that we have had a full year of that, finally, we've seen some market research here on where that money is going. Gas prices are down 20% in the past 12 months. Well, 19.2% if you want to be a jerk about it. So the average American has saved over $700 in the last year from the cheaper gas. Where did that money go? Now, it didn't go to savings accounts. They think only about 17% or about $119 out of the $700 went to actual savings account. Most of it went to increased spending. So let's look at where they went. A lot of it went to services. Some of it went to non-durable goods. Some of it, a very, very small amount, went to durable goods. But you know what the biggest single item on here where it went? Because savings account was actually second. That was 17%. 18% was the highest expenditure. It went to restaurants, Gregory. People treat themselves. That's what we did. We got an extra $700 in the last year from cheap gas. And we went to New Orleans Food and Spirits, or we went to Zia's, or we went to some place that serves teenagers when they're not supposed to. But that's what we do with it. We treat ourselves.
Ross on the Park, Brennan's.
Oh, man. If you want to start naming awesome restaurants, I'm starting to get hungry. Big Cheesy, I got to go back there. I haven't been there in a couple months.
Was there, just asking, since you were gone for a week,
mm-hmm.
So what's the place you have to go to since you're just getting back?
Now that I'm just getting back, I don't know. There's no chains because in Texas they have every chain there that we have here. They even have Raising Cane's and everything.
You know, Stacy's parents went with us on the Alaskan cruise. First place he had to go when he got back, Popeyes.
No, Popeyes. That's of all it. The places.
Like, he's like, darn near eats lunch there every day.
No, I was thinking way more kitschy than that. Like, not only what do they not have where I was, but what is something they only have in New Orleans? And what's something, I don't want to say eclectic, but, you know, not a burger or not a pizza. I was thinking something like a Big Cheesy. I would say Velvet Cactus, but they have Tex-Mex out the wazoo where I was this weekend.
Yeah, I was in Texas. I didn't have a cheeseburger on the cruise. I did have a steak. But I'll tell you, I didn't go on the cruise for the food, and good reason I didn't, because it wasn't about the food. But the Dungeness Crab Feast we had, and this was on one of the excursion, and that's why I chose it. That was the bomb.
Yeah, maybe like, I don't know, there's kind of a really cool place in Lakeview that I only go to like sparingly, but it's just different enough that Cava, it's right by your house. You know
yeah,
that place, Cava?
I've been there.
Pretty cool little place. But yeah, that's the first thing we went, though. That's the first thing us Americans did with our new savings on the gas money. We went to a restaurant. And why? Because restaurants are so good at what they do. How many restaurants do you just love? How many restaurants would you go to more often if you had more money?
I'd probably add a few more to the list.
Yeah. And the ones you love, you would probably spend more money there. The second biggest expense, well, I'm sorry, savings accounts was the second biggest expense, but the second biggest thing we went out and actually spent our money on instead of saving it was groceries. Which is weird because we ate the same amount last year as we did this year. We just managed to spend 10% more on our groceries this year. So what does that mean? Does that mean you're getting Knob Creek instead of Jim Beam? Does that mean you're getting steak instead of chicken nuggets? Where does that? We just invented another 10% on feeding ourselves. We weren't going hungry in 2014, Gregory. Did I print this one out for you? This is what the front looks like because the chart's on the back. Yeah, the chart's on the back. Flip it over. That's what I'm looking at there. You see right after total services, you see that grocery line there?
Yes.
Okay. You would think retail would be higher. Only 7% was spent on retail. When you look at department stores, 6%. Boy, retail's just not having a good go of it lately.
Well, you heard about Macy's this week.
They won by losing again. Addition by subtraction.
Yeah, they're closing 100 stores. I've not seen the list of who's closing.
It's you know what it looks like they're doing? Because I don't have this printed out because I didn't know you're going to ask me about it. But I read about this when their report came out. It looks like the focus of the closings is going to be in malls. The standalone stores, the ones that are in strip malls, or like these open-air shopping villages, like that giant one they just did between Covington and Mandeville off I-12 mm-hmm. and sort of where Brewster hits. Those are the ones that are surviving, but the ones that are traditionally like in a lakeside mall, those are the ones that are more likely to be closed than the open-air
ones.
Well,
that is the trend nationally, and it's shown up that way for a while, that malls are going away.
Kind of sad. Remember how when you were a teenager, were malls already a big deal, and y'all used to just go hang out at the mall, cruise the mall?
Yeah.
Just in summer, you just aimlessly walk around for a few hours, and you find people you know, and, you know, go to the cookie.
Go hang out at the mall.
The cookie counter. Yeah, I know. How not cool is that
but
when you're an adult?
But you'd have to think, you know, and it'll reduce the number of them in the city, because the ones that really are heavy traffic, I'm sure, would keep going. You know, example of Lakeside over here. When have you ever been in and it was like, God, there's nobody here?
I have, but it was 10 in the morning on a Tuesday.
Okay.
Yeah, and you want to talk about getting some funny looks. Be a middle-aged white guy pushing three kids around at Lakeside Mall at like 11 in the morning. People act like they just saw a leprechaun pop out the bottom of a rainbow. They're like, what are you doing? Does this even exist? Is this a unicorn? Can I take your picture? Do you need help? I can help you with that. You looks like you got your hands full. It's like, I'm fine. I do this every day. Stop acting like I'm a freak. You're looking at the chart now. Isn't this fascinating stuff? This is what y'all spend your money on. You know what the most disappointing part of this entire chart? Go to the right side. You see where it says home improvement? Only 2% of the money was spent on home improvement. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I noticed that.
You couldn't get some new windows or new window screens or a new doorbell or update your air conditioner or, you know, get some new furniture or repave your driveway or get a new roof or, you know, there's all kinds of to get it repainted because a house is always requiring some sort of upkeep and it's so expensive. You would think if you got a 700 extra bucks on your budget over the course of a year, more than 2% of that would have gone to home improvement. Very disappointing. We're just making bad decisions with this extra. We're just blowing it is what we're learning here, right?
What durable goods did get a little 6%?
Yeah, that counts as electronics, appliances, and home improvement. Yeah. There's your durable goods category.
Fridges, dishwashers. And
a new stereo system for the surround sound. For your, they didn't buy that. They bought 4% of that money was spent on electronics and appliances. Getting a new fridge because yours is on the fritz or that dishwasher makes too much noise. There's energy. That's not what we spend our money on. We spend our money on fun stuff.
Yep.
We fritted it away on restaurants and groceries.
And they didn't spend it on driving around the country this summer.
That's kind of a shock, too. You think that would incentivize driving?
Yeah, I would have thought that would have picked up. And that's what they were expecting is a lot of demand, and there wasn't.
We just treated ourselves, and we did most of it with our stomach. So if you add up restaurants and groceries, 28%. Of that $700 we saved on cheaper gas went straight to our big guts. Congratulations, America. Not shocked.
And it was good.
Well, you see Walmart fighting the downturn in retail. They bought Jet.com. Now, I'm not familiar with this website, but apparently I should be. It was worth $3.3 billion. So this is Walmart trying to accumulate some better resources to compete with Amazon. Because they have one advantage over Amazon. Stores.
Outlets, yeah.
Yeah. So
distribution centers.
I like that term. Did I hear you say that on Thursday?
I talked about it, and that's the mindset of if you've got to balance the brick and mortar with the web, the net, selling there, and allow them to pick up or ship from those centers locally. And you can get stuff there pretty quick. You just don't need as many footprints.
Yeah. Well, and there's a couple of things that the brick and mortars can do that Amazon can't. I'm real reticent to pick out a new TV without seeing it in action first. And you can't really do that on Amazon, you know, because you're limited to the resolution of your screen. You're not actually seeing what sort of picture that TV can put out, even if you do have video of it. You have to go stand in front of it and compare and contrast and see them side by side to see which brand and model and, you know, make actually is your favorite.
Well, on technical details, I'm speaking something that I'm used to doing is looking at those technical details, which tells me how it's going to look. Does it have all the stuff it's supposed to? And pricing tells you that too. You know, at 60 inch, you could buy it for $700 or you can pay $1,550 for it. It's going to have the stuff. That's what you're paying for.
You're going the $1,550 route?
Yeah.
All right.
But I am comparing those that have all the stuff. And I might choose one that costs the $50 less.
All right, if you got a financial situation, one segment left to get your question in. 504-260-0995. Coming up next, a little market chat. I'm James Parker. This is Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO.
What goes up must come down. Spinning wheel, got to go.
Welcome to Winning It Live with Gregory Ricks on News Talk 99.5 WRNO. I'm your co-host, James Parker. Gregory and I talked about this a little bit on Thursday's show, the birth of the VIX, the Volatility Index. And, you know, this caught our eye. What a strange day. Certain, by some means historic in the stock market. You had all three indices close at record highs all on the same day. It hadn't happened this millennium. When was the last time it happened? Back in 99 or 98? When was the last time we had all three of them? Can you remember that off the top of your head, Gregory?
I do not.
Yeah, it was either 99 or 98. But the other thing that kind of caught my eye was the volatility index took a nosedive on that same day, which if you're buying fear, that kind of doesn't make sense. They're all at record highs. And what happens when you're at record highs? You know, only way to go down is when you're at the top of the mountain, right? There's no other option. You would think the VIXY would be more attractive, but it went down. And then did you see what it did yesterday? VIXY went down another 1% and some change. So now our VIX is at 11.55. That's looking super attractive. And I just feel like I need to learn more about this because the charts, they're very enticing. I mean, it looks like we're in a position to score off of it. I just feel like I need to know more about it. So you were explaining to me where it came from, and it has its history in one of the greatest, most historic economic colleges known to man, the University of Chicago, home of Milton Friedman, and it, for a long time, it was the epicenter of capitalism. Maybe not so much these days, but at one time.
Yes. Professor Robert Whaley is the one that created the VIX, or the fear gauge, as he likes to call it. He is professor of, let's see, the Blair Bear Potter Professor of Management Finance at Vanderbilt University, who last year was awarded the William F. Sharp Lifetime Achievement Award and the Joseph W. Sullivan Award for Lifetime Contribution to the Options Industry. The story of VIX begins in the early 1990s with the Chicago Board Options Exchange. The CBOE wanted an index that would track near-term volatility of the stock market for two main reasons. First, it would provide an actual measure of expected short-term stock market volatility. Second, it would provide an index on which futures and option contracts could be written. At the core, what's going on, just to put it simple, because it is complicated, it measures, you see, when fear comes up, institutional firms typically are not selling their portfolios, but what they're doing is buying options to protect movement that is going in the wrong direction, say the market going down. So they'll pick up options. So when you see the fear part, that means there's more options and there's more calls being bought out there. And that's really what it's measuring.
And here's why I'm so interested in the VIXY. When you look at the 10-year chart, Gregory, there was one little spell in 2014, and it wasn't that long, where it was lower than it was today. Other than that, it hasn't been this low since the spring, February of 2007. So we're at basically a decade low. And does the same basic economic rule apply to the VIX, buy low, sell high? And if we're at a historic low, does that...
Here's what it's designed for. It's for the short term, just like I stated a moment ago. It's a short-term look. It's not for a long-term investment. And it's pretty much, if you think there's an opportunity on the low side and you look at it, just like the 1 year, or else there's not very long that there's flat, fearless periods. Don't last very long. And then all of a sudden, it spikes up. And you just grab that gain when it happens. So you're looking that if that's something you're going to do, you would find those lowest points, buy it, and you're not going to hold it for long.
Is this something that escapes most retail investors? I don't hear a lot about this from the brother-in-law factor.
Because, once again, it's more of a short-term play, whether it's a few days, few weeks, couple months. That's the extent of it. It's not some buy-and-hold tool that you would use for a long-term basis. But it also can act as a hedge in your portfolio to cushion or soften market movement.
You mean moving down?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the basics. Get complicated on me now, because now that I hear this, I'm still interested. I still want to know more. And I like to abuse your supercomputer financial brain over there. Tell me what else I need to know about this.
The VIX incorporates option prices in its formula. In the beginning, OEX options were used because those options were the most active. And that's the S&P 100 index that I was referring to. Because those options were the most active, accounting for 70% of total index option volume in 92. In contrast, option activity on the SPX, which is the S&P 500, was slightly over 16% total for that year. In 2008, white paper that Whaley wrote, Understanding VIX, He wrote that critical to the timeliness and usefulness of any implied volatility index, it is to have based on prices from deep and active index option market. Since S&P 100 options were the most actively traded, it was a natural choice. In the ensuing years, option volume on OEX declined and SPX option activity has increased as money managers began to incorporate put options as portfolio insurance. And we talk about a lot of things, insurance, just like a discussion the other day was about negative interest rates overseas, money flowing here, but they still had to pay a premium for insurance, which is the exchange rates on the dollar. Well, last week, that moved negative, that the insurance is costing so much that they can't make positive interest rates by moving assets to U.S. treasuries. So there's always forms of insurance or hedging against the other side. So did this shift, in, let's see, what did I state?
The part after the SPX?
Yeah, did this shift affect integrity of the past VIX data? Whaley wrote in the same article that January of 86 through October 2008, the average daily return on OEX and SPX were nearly identical at 0.0236% and 0.0266% respectively. The standard deviation of their daily returns was marginally different at 1.182% and 1.138%. Lastly, the daily correlation was near perfect, 0.9898. Over this period, Whaley concluded that for all intents and purposes, the S&P 100 and S&P 500 index portfolios are perfect substitutes.
Substitutes for what? Not getting in the VIX?
No, they did a shift. I missed that back here, but there was a shift where they, because remember, OEX, they shifted to SPX from OEX.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so the back study showed that even though they swap places being more popular, all the testing says they're close from that period to when S, because OEX used to be the most popular options, and then the SPX shifted and took that place, and historicals didn't vary when looking back at all the historicals. The same percentages held really close, so it wasn't a big change in the fear index.
So how novice does it sound that I want to buy into this because I expect at some point there's going to be a pop and then all I have to do is pay attention to the chart and sell. Is it really that simple or am I still rolling the dice? Because it seems like there's almost no downside, I guess, is what I'm trying to get
well,
at.
Well, there is still downside because a little bit of movement can exacerbate the percentage. But if you understand what you're trying to do over the coming months, and that's where do we have some possible effect on the market coming up in the next 90 days?
Yeah, we definitely do. There's an election happening.
Yeah, along with a lot of other problems that just aren't showing their head or possible things that could happen to pop up. But I'd say you're pretty good in the next 90 days going to get a significant pop on that and you sell it. But that's what you got to be looking for. What do you think's coming, or are you using that as a hedge to protect against possibly what might come? Because all of a sudden, the option, you know, and that's what it's showing is, so you're going to have to be slightly ahead of the curve because all of a sudden, when fear shows up, it's too late to buy the VIX if you're wanting to buy the VIX. You're going out there and actually getting those options at that time. But those options are becoming much more expensive because of the demand as well.
Like you can't get a power of attorney when you need
one? It's going to tell you what's coming slightly ahead of it.
All right. We got 1 minute left. Let's tell the guy listening why he needs to come to our live event on Tuesday. Gregory Ricks Live. Ruth, Chris, and Metairie, 6:30 p.m.
It's a great tire-kicking session. A chance to meet the Total Wealth Authority, to hear me speak. Of that hour, I'm probably speaking 35, 40 minutes tops of that, but a chance to get to know me in person and break bread together.
Yeah, and I have this app in my phone that lets me look at your financial situation, and it's a disaster. You need to get it together. It's called the, it's not the Gregory Ricks and Associates app. This is the James is Full of It app. So, no, look, you've been talking about, you got this big nest egg, but, you know, you have a lot of uncertainty in the future, and You know you're not the pro that Gregory Ricks is. Come on out. See if you want to come on board and be part of the team. Meet the rest of the team, and we'd love to have you out. Reserve your seat. Call the office, 504-832-9200, or go to gregoryricks.com. Thanks for tuning in. Mortgage Gumbo with Dwayne Stein next. I'm James Parker. This is Winning It Life with Gregory Ricks. You're listening to News Talk 99.5 WRNO.
Winning at Life with Gregory Ricks is copyrighted by Gregory Ricks for the private use of our audience. Any unauthorized use of this broadcast without express consent by Gregory Ricks is prohibited.